Hi, everyone, and welcome to today's SeedWorld Innovation Series webinar. My name is Mark Zinkowitz, and I serve as Associate Editor for SeedWorld. And today I'm happy to be your host. Today's theme is From Table to Farm, How Consumer Demand Will Yield Change. I'd like to take a minute to thank Benson Hill for partnering with us on this Innovation Series webinar. Presenting our webinar today is Ken Dahlmeier, President and Chief Operating Officer of Clarkson Grain Company. Clarkson Grain supplies organic and non-GMO grains and oilseeds to clients in North and South America, Asia, and the EU who demand identity-preserved grain that's up to their standards. Products made from raw materials provided by Clarkson Grain appear in almost every grocery store in the U.S. Ken earned his Bachelor of Science at the University of Illinois and his PhD from Iowa State University. He's held management positions with his family business, Sturdy Grow Hybrids, as well as Syngenta Seeds, Agribull, and Clarkson Grain Company. He served on the board of Illinois Foundation Seeds as well. He's now serving on the board of the U.S. Soy Export Council and the Organic Trade Association's Global Supply Chain Integrity Task Force. Now, during our presentation, you'll likely have some questions for Ken. Please type these into the chat box at any time during the webinar, and we'll address them during the Q&A session we'll hold after he finishes his presentation. We'll also have some poll questions during the webinar. These will pop up in your chat box for you to answer. And today's webinar is being recorded and will be made available at seedworld.com. We'll also be sending out an email with a link to the webinar. Now, today you're going to learn how to better navigate the potential impacts of trade embargoes on commodity markets. You'll learn why supply and demand will become demand and supply, crucial difference. You'll learn why yield might not be the only road to profit. You'll learn how to assess the impact purpose-driven consumers will make on the industry. And you'll learn to ensure that you're at the forefront of change. Ken, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Mark. I appreciate the introduction and the overview of what we're going to talk about. First, thank you to Benson Hill and to SeedWorld for sponsoring the webinar series and for giving us an opportunity to share some of our views with the audience. I think it's always helpful to know the context from where a speaker is coming from. So I'll start by saying that we in Clarkson Grain are merchants. We are not missionaries. And while I'll talk about non-GM and organic row crops, this certainly isn't an evangelist revival. This is a discussion about market distinctions and how to satisfy demand rather than focusing upon greater supply. I thought this recent tweet summed up the frustration that we often see in production agriculture. We can identify with both speakers, and the distinction between the two is their concentration on either the market with capital M or the markets with a lowercase m. The market itself concentrates upon a pool of demand. It has a differentiated product that's harder to copy. And importantly, it has less price sensitivity. The markets, lowercase m, on the other hand, are essentially a platform to efficiently determine the lowest price for a given supply. It relies upon non-differentiated product of larger and larger piles. What we're going to try to talk about and the concept, the key concept for today, is we need to think beyond the pile and how to serve the market instead of enforcing a least cost definition of the markets. Our experience at Clarkson Grain is working on the margins and creating net margin for our growers by thinking outside of that commodity pile. As J.P. Ray recognizes, for the foreseeable future, non-GMO and organic customer demand will play a significant role in the market. So there will be three poll questions, just to make sure everybody's still with me and still awake. So our first poll question is here to introduce the next concept that we will cover. And it is, who was the U.S. president during the first significant trade embargo or trade war? So if you'll put your answer in the chat box, we'll give about three breaths. The chat box on the right, and the answers will come at the end. Who was the first U.S. president to embark upon a significant trade embargo or trade war? Okay, so let's start from the beginning. What's so wrong with the current supply-based system? In general, the party that has an oversupply is in an inherently weaker position in global trade. Even though your biggest customer has a great need for the commodity that you're selling, alternative supply or alternative supply chains and alternatives to what you're selling create potent levers in any negotiation. I believe that we can look back to the Carter embargo and the embargoes of Jefferson, hint, hint, to take some lessons from history. Frankly, what we've seen is trade is often the soft weapon of nations. The United States lost the ability to define what the world ate by what we had to sell almost 30 years ago. We've seen that China, Brazil, and India are no fools. They each recognize the risk to food security and the opportunity of being able to spread that risk back in the 1970s, and they systematically invested in their own infrastructure and their infrastructure to bring in product from the world. Trade actions have always been the catalyst to new entrants into that marketplace. We see this in the widening red and blue graphs that began up in 2016. But we see the parity from 2002, when Brazil's infrastructure investments started to come online. Going forward, U.S. agriculture needs to concentrate upon diversity, quality, reliability, and just as important, transparency to accelerate opportunity for the ag sector. This means lessening our infatuation with the pile. Next poll question. Since the rise of the middle class is now a global trend, how has that changed customer buying habits in the U.S.? So in 2017, what percentage of U.S. households have at least one organic product in the cupboard? At least one organic product in the cupboard. Put your answers over in the chat box there on the right, and Mark will go over the answers at the end. Okay. Let's talk a little bit more about how social values can drive market opportunity. So kind of taking some of these examples in detail, we now see fruit in a Happy Meal. We also see General Mills purchasing and is operating over 30,000 acres of land to supply itself with sustainable grain. We see Clif Bar focused upon child and teen nutrition just as much as adults. Do you know what the first product Anheuser-Busch sends to a hurricane region? It's not the Bud Light Night. Anheuser switches their brewing lines to canning water and shipping water to areas in need. What tremendous social value that brings to the brand. But again, this is we're merchants. We are not missionaries. And from a purely merchant point of view, the largest investment funds or the largest pension funds or the largest investment index funds have rules that dictate environmental improvement metrics for the companies in which they invest. If a company does not meet that metric or those metrics, the funds do not inject the capital. It's very, very simple, and it becomes very, very real for the largest companies. Surprisingly, the grocery companies driving the conversion of sustainable food, lower pesticide use, and increased organic shelf space are Walmart, Costco, and Kroger. The organic industry is a $50 billion industry with year-over-year growth that is the envy of the market. Other market distinctions such as non-GMO project verified, pesticide-free, kosher, halal, and so on are also providing market share growth. The trend is that today's customer expects a level of transparency never before seen. Producers, and in this case, seed companies who support those producers, who can supply that level of management and transparency, have new opportunity for net margin and net income. Finally, I think U.S. agriculture is facing a transition crisis. Most farms in the U.S. are family owned. And when the current generation of producers undertook their transition, there were two big differences that I see. First, most of the land in their operation was family owned, and the average size of a farm was smaller, 300 to 500 acres. The passage of family owned land is in many ways cleaner and less subject to competitive forces for control outside of the family. In 2020, most of that land is now rented and is rented from absentee landowners who are going through their own transition from generation to generation. The new generation of landowners are removed from the land and have a very different set of social values than did their parents and grandparents. Topics such as soil preservation, pesticide use, production schemes, and how to satisfy the market are forces that new landowners and current tenants now need to navigate. It seems the amount of owner-operated land has declined, or at least stabilized at best, over this generation of producers. I think it's unrealistic that new farmers can slide into the capital and management need for a 3,000 to 5,000 acre farm. Many just don't try because they don't see a future in it. I think the principal challenge to agriculture is changing the mindset from surviving on 3,000 to 5,000 acres to thriving on 300 to 500 acres. The key to answering this challenge is to expand our pool of trainees beyond the immediate family and think about new sources of enthusiasm in production agriculture. Secondly, I think we need to alter our definition of success from I'm successful because I produce 80 bushel beans to I am successful because I net $200 an acre. Reducing costs over bushels is a race to the bottom, and it feeds the pile. We know this is not sustainable in the long term, and identifying new world markets and new domestic demand can add value throughout the supply chain and reduce our dependence on moving the pile. Sustainability is not sustainable unless the economics works. It's a simple game. Even though the 2019 data is not yet available, this shows a comparison published in 2018 by the Flanagan State Bank in Illinois. The data used in their analysis was put together by FinBin across the Midwest, so the data is very comprehensive and doesn't cherry pick examples. The power of paying attention to the market, capital M, is clear. And there are 186 good reasons per acres to engage beyond the pile. In fact, our experience in Central Illinois is that our best organic and specialty growers net more than their commodity neighbors gross per acre. So what do we see into the future? For the 2020 crop year, we see crop premiums for organic and non-GM row crops holding fairly steady. Non-GM premiums can be boosted a little bit further by growing identity-specific varieties for food and specialty feed uses. The seed companies who serve them have the opportunity to gain distinction and a broader reach of the customer. The final poll question is pretty much a shameless commercial for Clarkson Grain. If you're interested in learning more about the opportunities for you or for your customers in premium markets that we serve, please drop us an email at info@clarksongrain.com. And by the way, the answer to this one will be a gimme, is all of the above. So I think we've made a bit of a case for paying attention to the market rather than concentrating just on the markets. And so the question at hand is, what impact can the seed industry have to help take advantage of these opportunities? How can members have an impact and serve the market? The first thing that we can do is to talk to food and feed manufacturers that are in our market area to determine what the unmet demand is. In our experience, that unmet demand can be protein, it can be amino acid profile, it can be identity preserved supply chains that serve to control process variability. Because the biggest source of inefficiency for a food or a feed processor is oftentimes variability of the grain going into the system. You reduce that variability and you've created value that can be passed down through the supply chain. Secondly, seed companies can engage with export organizations such as USEC, the U.S. Soy Export Council, and the U.S. Grains Council to understand how they can provide incremental to understand how export markets provide incremental demand. But remember that many of those new markets are not necessarily interested in what is in the pile. New markets and large new markets are oftentimes not in GMO-friendly regions of the world. So we need to continue to invest in non-GM products, non-GM portfolios, and non-GM breeding. Because increased premiums are generally the lowest hanging fruit in the industry, and non-GM is often a prerequisite for entry into that market. Companies such as Benson Hill, Pioneer, Bex, AgriLiant, as well as Albert Lee Seeds, Blue River, and Blue River continue to serve customers looking for market distinctions. New companies such as Equinom and Calyx are entering the market with targeted breeding programs. I always say we don't, you know, names have power. And the newest of the technologies that are generating targeted variability have often been called gene editing. We need to remember that if we want to make a market nervous, call new technologies something that seems to make them question. CRISPR is a gray area in that crop regulation system. Even though the U.S. has classified it as non-GM, Europe and other parts of the world has classified it as equivalent to a GMO. And therefore, we need to be completely transparent as we enter some of those markets. Again, we're merchants. We're not missionaries. And personally, I think targeted breeding programs using CRISPR have a tremendous opportunity. Finally, the last topic there. Finally, we need to be open to the idea of net income and not just gross yield. The market does not care and does not add value to yield like it adds value to social distinctions. However, the markets always appreciate a growing pile. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Mark, and we'll go for some questions I hope that that folks have put in, as well as answering the poll questions.
Thank you so much, Ken. And yes, we do have some questions. And if you have a question that you'd like to ask, please type it into the chat box at any time. And as Ken said, we're going to go over the results of our poll questions. If I had a drum here, I would give a little drum roll. But the first poll question, who the first U.S. president was during the first significant trade embargo and trade embargo/trade war, was President Thomas Jefferson. That's interesting, Ken. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that the moral of this story might be that trade embargoes or trade wars go back a long way and are really nothing new, I suppose.
No, that kind of showed a bit of my age. Anyway, I'm not as old as Thomas Jefferson, but you know, many of our people and I had to explain to my kids that, you know, the current trade disruption is not a new thing, and the current administration did not invent it. So the history around that is Washington specifically stayed away from trade embargoes because he felt the United States, the infant United States, was not ready to do such a thing. Jefferson was pushed by different pirates and different things, as well as Great Britain, to stop trade. And in 1807, put an embargo upon Europe and Great Britain. And the eventual outcome of that happened to be the War of 1812.
Poll question number two. In 2017, what percentage of American households had at least one organic product in the cupboard? The answer was 82%. So most U.S. households have at least one organic product in their cupboard. That's fascinating. Ken, can you shed some light on this? Do a lot of these households, maybe some people don't even realize they've bought an organic product? And I know I talk to some people who say, you know, I don't I don't buy organic products. I stay away from that kind of thing. Or some people say, no, I always buy organic products. So what's going on here? Can you shed a little bit of light on this number and why it's so many and what that means?
So I think it's really interesting because it is, if you go down the grocery stores, the only key place that is expanding shelf space is organic protein, organic chicken breasts. And the conventional wisdom was it was just an East Coast, West Coast thing, or it was an affluent, non-affluent distinction, or only the young people are buying it. The older consumer really doesn't pay any attention. But as people actually went in and looked at the data and looked at the UPC scan data, it was quite the opposite. It's not a coasty thing. It's not necessarily associated with affluence, and age really doesn't have the influence of what we thought. I take my own, my own family, and my father is in his 80s, and there are organic products in his cupboard. Our children are in their early 20s, and they also have organic products in their cupboard. So some of the conventional wisdom had been proven to be not accurate.
Poll question number 3: which of the following crops have premium contracting opportunities with Clarkson Grain? Now, you mentioned already it was all of the above, and so I'm going to say as well that the moral of this story, I think, is that there's a lot of opportunities in this sector.
There are, not only within Clarkson Grain, but in almost every region of the country, there is a market for distinction. And if you're in a northern environment, then there is a market for small grains of specific varieties or organics. If you're in the south, there are other crops that are as well. There's there's also a growing and abutting local trend that can be served by the seed industry as well. So it's not just a produce thing, although produce does drive it quite a bit. Think about how you can support your local customers in their own market space.
We're going to take a few questions now. Again, if you have a question, please type it into the chat box. Ken, first question, you already answered this one during your presentation, but I think it's worth reiterating it. This question came quite early on during your talk, but the question was, is gene editing considered GMO or non-GMO? Now, you mentioned that that's a very complicated question, and when consumers ask that question, when they hear about something like CRISPR, they say, oh, CRISPR, is this one of those GMO things? The answer really is not a simple one. Can you shed a little more light on that for us? Because I understand, for example, the European Union has said that we're going to treat gene editing technologies like CRISPR the same way we would GMOs, for example. But in other areas of the world, it's not like that at all. This is still something that's being decided. There's a lot of debate, a lot of discussion. What's the situation right now?
So the answer to the question is, as you say, the answer to the question is, it depends. It depends on the part of the world and the history around GMO acceptance in that part of the world. The U.S. Has said that CRISPR and that technology is non-GM. And therefore does not have the regulation that that traditional GMO crops have had. The opposite is true in the EU. The EU has said that it will classify CRISPR and that technology as a GMO. So what that then, so then Japan is going down the decision tree that it will likely not be classified as a GM product. However, their food industry is very concerned about knowing which varieties are derived through CRISPR and which varieties are not. So so it depends upon the place in the world that you're trying to sell to. So that gets back to the ability to see market opportunity and transparency, and moving forward with the information to your customers so that they can represent it correctly.
Next question. This goes back to what you were talking about earlier, Ken, with regard to the yield is king line of thinking. The question is, how do we shift the mindset how do we shift the mindset away from yield and focus more on quality and value add aspects that can drive more return per acre? This person points out that farmers are paid on yield, and it is challenging to shift this mindset. Again, yield is king, right? It's such a,
sure,
a dominant belief in the industry. How do we begin to tackle that and turn things around?
Sure. And that's how we were all trained. You know, we were all trained that our metric of success is I produce high yields. And to shift that metric, not only in our own minds, but in our customers' minds, is a big challenge. And some folks just will not make the shift. Others will tend to be a little bit more open to that shift. So if I can see if I can control this going, yeah, there we go. Going back to this set of this slide here, the people who are in the on kind of the right hand side of that grouping of four, they have a different mindset, a different expectation of what agriculture is you know can become than what we were grown up with and what we were trained with. I think the thing that we have to understand is that the first thing for a business to do is to remember that big A agriculture is global and it underpins the markets. But the seed business is still very, very local, and it can satisfy the market on a local scale, on a local or a regional or a national scale, and to keep their breeding programs engaged to satisfy the market in their sales areas. So as we start to hear, you know, different market opportunities, the seed companies who can help them engage in those, I think we'll see that their market share in those regions will increase. It will take some time, you know, and as what I always say, farming is a spectator sport. As folks see their neighbors have more financial success on less land than, you know, how they're trying to survive on larger parcels of land, we within Clarkson Grain are starting to get a lot more questions about how to engage. And it's from growers that are trying to come into the market, trying to come into production agriculture, but it's also some of the more established growers who are trying to diversify their operation as well. So it does take quite a bit of time.
Next question, still talking about this yield is king line of thinking and how do we change it. The question is there a rule of thumb in regards to how much yield reduction is acceptable for seed that provides an additional benefit, for example, favorable protein or various nutrient contents? I guess another way to put this question is how much of a yield reduction might producers be willing to accept? Is there any insights you can provide on that, Ken? I guess sure. how much of a hit might producers be willing to take, I guess?
Right. So in some of the varieties that we utilize for our export market, the yield decline is as much as 20%. And so because of that, the premium and the not only this the non-GM or the organic premium is applied, but also a premium recognizing the value of that specific variety to the customer is also applied. So if we think, you know, ADM in Decatur, Illinois today is paying about $1.60 over cash for non-GM corn or non-GM soy, sorry, for non-GM soybeans. But the premium that we would contract for a specific variety of non-GM could be upwards of $2 to $2.50 for that yield difference in that marketplace. So again, if the mindset is I'm successful because I produce a lot of soybeans, that's one point of view. If the mindset is I'm successful because I net $200 an acre, then yield, raw yield, gross yield doesn't play as much of a role as much as how do I satisfy new market demand.
Ken, do you think farmers who are planting primarily non-GM will be interested in gene-edited varieties or wary of them? And what about farmers who focus on organic? Do you have any insights for us there?
So CRISPR has been forbidden by the National Organic Program for the United States. So that question has been answered for the time being. On the non-GM part, it depends upon where that market is, you know, where that grain is going to go. So personally, I think that there is a lot of opportunity with CRISPR and targeted variation. And I think that has a lot to do with, you know, making novel starches for different food applications, but also helping to control different types of grain diseases and improve food quality. So there's from my personal point of view, I think it has a lot of opportunity. Again, we're merchants. And we have to be completely transparent with our customers on how the different varieties were developed. And it is one of the first questions that we get asked whenever we start talking with a food processor, especially a food processor outside of the United States, about how a specific variety was developed. Was it developed using CRISPR? Was it not? And that's more of a market distinction on their side.
Can you talk a little bit about diversifying yields? Can you give a few examples of how we can do that?
Diversifying yields.
Diversifying the market, sorry.
Oh, okay, great. So we currently, you know, in central Illinois, it's basically a corn and soybean rotation. Within an organic system, you need to have a third crop and you need to have cover crop as well. So the opportunity actually is how to think about new markets and serving new markets with a third crop. The challenge is, of course, you can't just take alfalfa hay to the elevator. You have to think about how you're going to market yourself. So diversifying, going into, you know, thinking about white corn or blue corn as opposed to just straight yellow corn for feed, that is, you know, to me, that's kind of low hanging fruit. Thinking about, you know, a portion of your acres being non-GM versus traditional GMO crop, to me, that's diversification. We're seeing people look for new and diverse markets for, say, value-added hay, or thinking about just in our local area, sunflowers for birdseed is another market that we're looking to develop to help some of our people make the transition and from traditional GM crop production into organics. So it's it's starting to think outside the pile. What can we take? What lessons can we take from our fathers and grandfathers about diversifying their operation to weather some of these storms?
And speaking about our fathers and grandfathers, what do you think of the boom in hemp production in the United States, Ken? And can hemp play a role? Of course, George Washington was a hemp grower in his time. Do you see any potential here as that market begins to build?
Yes, in areas, and the thing that any new market needs to pay attention to is the issue of oversupplying before a demand has been or a supply chain has been created, and we see that with hemp currently. Hemp, of course, was a fiber crop, not only for Washington and his contemporaries, but all the way through the Second World War. And so, bringing that back, you can produce a whole lot of CBD oil on a fairly small number of acres. And if the regulation in the marketplace is not able to accept that, then you've created an oversupply situation, and and the price is going to be challenged. Right now, you can buy a whole lot of CBD crude oil from growers because kind of got ahead of their skis just a little bit. So I think that is going to be a very interesting market. I think there's potential there, but we have to make sure that we don't see it as a savior. Those of us of an age have seen several savior crops come and go, and we need to need to make sure we don't get out ahead of what the demand is going to be. Good question.
Well, thank you so much, Ken. That's actually all the time we have today. So I'd like to thank you very much, Ken, for taking the time to speak with us today, and to Benson Hill for making this webinar possible. And a big thank you to all of you for spending your lunch hour with us. We hope you've found this information valuable. Again, a recording of this webinar will be made available at seedworld.com. Thank you again, and we hope you have a terrific day. This is Mark Zinkowitz of SeedWorld signing off.
Thank you very much for all your time.